We are taping this on Martin Luther King Day. I'm Brian Gibberman. It's the Podium Game Podcast, joined by Seth Partnow from many of websites, including the Nylon Calculus and others. But we're going to, Seth, first off, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing well. All right, so we're in like the middle of football. Like, football playoffs are going on, the college football. Do you do anything else?
This year I'm one of the people who I haven't made a big deal about it, but I'm kind of boycotting NFL this year, so I've watched none football. And I've never been I grew up in Alaska and I went to a small college, so I've never really gotten college football. So in terms of other sports I watch, probably my second is soccer, specifically Premier League.
Okay, so you used to watch football, but you stopped this year. All right. Okay.
Yeah, and whether I go back next year, it's aside from yesterday when Twitter went crazy during the NFC Championship game, I actually haven't missed it that much, to be honest.
Interesting. All right, well, you had a good story on bballbreakdown.com where you talked about Doc Rivers and his dual role as coach and general manager. What is the main problem that you see with what he's trying to do?
I think in that piece I talked specifically about Doc's performance, but I think that it's generalizable to, anyone. I think that, I've had some criticisms of Stan Van Gundy, and, I guess my anti-Josh Smith waiver position is controversial now, but the two jobs are both too time-consuming for one person and kind of almost at cross-purposes, just in terms of the time horizon you're dealing with. If you're a coach and you're thinking, a week out, maybe. If you're the general manager, and, I use that term loosely. I know Detroit has a, quote, general manager, but in common parlance, colloquially, Van Gundy is acting as the GM. So I've been called out on that before, and I'm aware that they have the Jeff Bowers there, but Van Gundy is the decision maker. But that decision making role is just thinking longer term. It's also, the coach is looking inward and the general manager is looking outward. It's just not realistic to expect someone to do that job well while doing both.
So you think there needs to be basically more of checks and balances to have someone the person who's in charge of the basketball operations department to be someone who has more of a long-term look than someone who's so involved of the day-to-day success of the team. Because the coach, kind of goes into tanking. Like, with Brett Brown, even though whatever the Philadelphia 76ers front office is trying to do, his main goal every day is to be trying to win games and prepare the team to win games. So you kind of see the parallel there with,
yeah.
I'm using an example of a different team, but you could see that same issue with a team like the Pistons and the Clippers.
Absolutely. And that's exactly right. You can see why Stan Van Gundy, the coach, wanted to be rid of Josh Smith. You can see why Doc Rivers, the coach, knew he needed to upgrade his bench. The fact that he needed to upgrade his bench because of the failings of Doc Rivers, the GM, is kind of a funny thing there. But you can see, but how they went about doing it, it's for coaching this team, I have to make this move, and let me do it as quickly as possible. Whereas if there's someone who's, that's their gig, it's like they have a meeting and say, all right, we're going to upgrade our bench. I'll let you know what comes up, coach. And then, you end up with, I think, a better deal looking at the league as a whole. All right, I'll buy the Clippers needed a upgrade at kind of a backup perimeter position. Are you telling me that even aside from the family relationship, which makes that situation even sillier, There's just no way that you scour the league and say, you know, for a second rounder, the best perimeter guy we can get is Austin Rivers. And I think that's just a function of a coach not having the time to kind of familiarize themselves with the, you know, the eighth and ninth men around the league who might fit that role and be available for the price that the Clippers had to offer.
All right, let's start. You started kind of digging into Doc right there. Let's take a look at this Clippers situation specifically. And I think we have to go even farther back than that. We have to go right when he took over. And pretty much I don't know if it was the first move he made, but the first major move he made is probably, from a big picture standpoint, also the biggest mistake he made. J.J. Redick's a nice player, and Dudley's bounced back this year for the Bucks, but he wasn't very good for the Clippers last year. But Eric Bledsoe is pretty much exactly what the Clippers need, and especially when you consider how the salary cap's going to go with the new collective bargaining agreement and the TV, or not the new collective bargaining agreement, the new TV deal, that it really wasn't unreasonable for them to be able to keep Paul and Bledsoe both on the team.
Yeah, I think in retrospect, that deal obviously looks very not good. I think if that's not the fairest way to judge the deal. I think you have to kind of go back to the time it was made. And, you know, even at the time it was made, you can say, well, you know, with Bledsoe this, J.J. Redick that, what have you. I think it's defensible. I mean, I think that with, you know, concerns about Bledsoe's knee and the fact that he'd never been a full-time, you know, starter and what is he positionally and how well does he play with Blake Griffin, you know, J.J. Redick adding the shooting they needed, Jared Dudley would have been, you know, pretty much exactly what last year and this year's Clippers team needed. So I think from the standpoint of that deal, it's at least defensible at the time it was made. It's obviously, you know, Bledsoe has you know, hit his potential, and Dudley's done what he did, and here we are, and it's worked out badly. So I think there's our mutual friend Fred Katz, I think, ties, you know, kind of ties that as kind of Doc's original sin as a GM. three Jews talking about original sin anyway. I think that's, again, that's at least defensible. I think it's the moves after that and kind of the smaller moves that have been really where he gotten himself into trouble. I mean, the Clippers bench last year was bad because it was filled with Byron Mullins and Antoine Jameson and all these guys who, you know, all right, it's always dicey to find, like, you know, guys at the minimum and low contracts who can contribute, but these were hopeless shots that were being taken.
Yeah.
You know, to the fact where, you know, when they signed Glenn Davis last year, it was unmistakably an upgrade. And think about that. I mean, you know, Glenn Davis got waived in Orlando, bought out in Orlando, and you know, people following the Clippers were like, wow, Glenn Davis actually helps us with our front line depth. And that's the situation the team was in. So, and that's, you know, that's on Doc. And then coming into this year, I think it all kind of stems from the Hawes deal. He's been bad, but it's not just that. It's the way that deal was structured, using the mid-level exception, the way they did, put them in a situation where they had to dump salary because of the mid-level exception imposes a hard cap on a team and so on and so forth. So that, you know, kind of leads to a chain reaction of events where now they're dumping Dudley with a first round pick and all these other deals, and it's all just kind of spiraled from each deal being very in the moment, what do I have to do to solve the immediate problem without as much of a view towards the medium and longer term as might be helpful.
And they've just gotten, I mean, there, you can find minimum salary guys in this league that can contribute and help teams. There's guys everywhere. You could go to the D League right now, and I can't personally do it. I don't have access to be able to watch D League games on a regular basis. But when you have guys scouting,
yeah, just talk.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's kind of the point.
Yeah, No, you're exactly right. But the Hidus and the Glenn Davises, I mean, the Epe Udos, who he hasn't really gotten a chance this year.
Yeah.
I'm assuming there's a reason for that. He's dealt with a bunch of injuries in his career, but in theory, he was the type of guy that made sense that they really could have used if you got him from when he was playing at the level that he was expected to. But he really hasn't gotten a chance to play.
Well, and that was that deal was kind of as part of one of the things they got back in the Dudley deal was Miroslav Radulica, and he's now in Minnesota having come back from Europe. But it's, you know, he was as good a gamble, probably better than Udo, but they, you know, waived him, paid him to go away so they could sign a guy who's, you know, at best a similar player. And, you know, it's pretty deep dive into the weeds to you know, have seen what Radulica did and I really hope I'm pronouncing that right, what he did in Milwaukee during his first season. But that's the kind of thing that if you're, you know, that's where you make your money as a dedicated, you know, general manager, player personnel guy. And I'm sure that they have people in the organization doing that, but if the decision maker isn't taking that information on board, it doesn't matter if someone in the organization knows these things.
And then the Rivers deal, to me, it's just, look, he's been better this year, which that's not saying much.
Yeah.
His biggest skill is that he can get to the foul line a little bit. It's something he does reasonably okay. But outside of that, it's just not everything else he does poorly doesn't make that skill worth it.
And he doesn't even shoot free throws particularly well, does he?
No, I'd say in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I don't want to pile on that trade just because it's just so, you know, obviously ridiculous.
No, they gave up. They never gave Reggie Bullock a shot.
So, absolutely.
Jordan Farmar's, for I don't know what went wrong there, that it just seems like the two weren't on the same page, but that didn't work. Oh, to be fair, Rivers is shooting 75% from the line. That's not
okay.
That's not terrible.
Okay.
But and then who was the other? Didn't they give up someone else too? They gave up a pick.
Crystal Blix Roberts.
Yeah.
And
so they gave up three players who I would consider better than Austin Rivers to get Austin. That's my biggest problem. If they just signed him and didn't have to do anything else, okay. I mean,
yeah.
I wouldn't loved it, but I'd be all right with it.
Another writer at B-Ball Breakdown, Rafael Uhara, I think he talked about this a little bit on Twitter, is that this is, you know, it's just kind of a failure of asset management, and you know, I'm as uncomfortable as anyone with the, you know, referring to players as assets, but in this case, it's apt, because, you know, Doc is like, well, okay, Bullock isn't going to play, this second rounder is three years down the road, CDR isn't in the rotation, so I'm basically adding Austin for free, is, you know, from the coach's standpoint. Now, you know, Phoenix didn't need to be convinced to snap up Reggie Bullock, let's put it that way, even though they have no place for him to play, and you know, it's free money for them. And the second rounder isn't nothing, and it could have been used to you know, pick up a vet on a bad contract, probably not this year, obviously, with the salary cap, but maybe next year or something. It was a bullet they had to fire at some point, and he just kind of shot it off into the air. And again, that's just the differing perspective from the coach, where, you know, all right, these guys, losing these guys isn't going to impact this team right now, versus, you know, a longer term view of kind of the net assets of the franchise from a basketball standpoint.
You didn't like this move. This is one I actually didn't mind. I thought Dejounte Jones made sense for what they needed. He's not a good offensive player, but he at least brings some wing defense to the table, which they need off the bench.
I that's you know, this is now into kind of a weakness of Doc the Coach, is the, you know, dependence on veterans. It's like Dante Jones has never been a good NBA player, but he's been a not good NBA player for a long time. So therefore he kind of gets more, you know, immediate chances than Reggie Bullock ever did. And, you know, Reggie Bullock has, you know, he hasn't been great in limited time, but that's the thing, limited time. And it's, you know, you got to see what you have. And I don't really think that they did that. And the fact that they had no problem finding someone to take him kind of, you know, says what it does about the view around the league of the chance of Reggie Bullock turning into, you know, a decent 3-and-D guy.
Now, this Clippers team is weird because I'm on the same page as you. Like, when it comes down to the playoffs, I just don't like how the team is constructed. Matt Barnes is an integral part to them, and he's played well this regular season.
Yeah.
But there's something about teams relying on Matt Barnes to hit a bunch of wide-open shots in the playoffs is something I don't know if I'm comfortable with, and that's what it comes down to. Teams just leave him and they concentrate on the other players. And you have two guys out in the court in Jordan and Barnes who they're going to shy away from. They're going to obviously cut Jordan's dives to the basket, and they're going to pay attention to him when he's roaming the baseline and they're running pick and rolls with Blake. But that's two guys you can kind of be like, all right, we can kind of shift away from him. And that's a problem. But they're 27-14. They're the sixth seed in the West. They have a plus .62 point differential. Memphis, who's in third, has a 4.1. Houston, who's in fourth, has a 4.0. And the Blazers, who are in second, have a 6.3. Are we being unfair to the Clippers a little bit?
I don't think so, because again, you look at their team, and you know they have, you know, they can play six guys really that you feel okay about in a playoff situation, and that's just not, they're basically, they're, you know, they go with these bench units and they're spotting, you know, opposing teams 4 or 5 points at a stretch, and it's so competitive in the West. I don't think you can do that over a series. I mean, you know, things can happen and they can win a series or two, but you're expecting them to, you know, these six guys to take them to a title in one of the more competitive and top-heavy, you know, NBA seasons that we can really remember. And it's just, you know, there's something that's just not there, despite, you know, it's weird because, it, you know, they're on pace for 55 wins, but they seem almost irrelevant to the outcome of this season. That seems bizarre to say, but I can't get around that.
Yeah, I just don't buy it. I'm not buying them. I'm with you. And I think just weird is the right way to put it. A team that's this good in the regular season to just have so much doubt when the games matter is something unusual in a territory I don't know if I've ever really been. And it's not Pacers level from last year. I don't think it's anything like that, because they're not playing that poor. They haven't hit a stretch of play that's torpedoed like Indiana did.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's a little like Portland last year, where they're good, but you're like, yeah, but you know, they like, you kind of knew that last year's Portland team had a ceiling on it. You know, based on their, I mean, again, their depth and they that last year's Portland didn't play great defense, and you just kind of, you know, they're like, it's like that, except without the kind of, at least last year's Blazers team had some excitement because they were new, and this Clippers team doesn't really even have that kind of excitement factor. So it's you know, it's weird, because how does a team with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin seem bland? But they kind of do.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, we've been there, done that with the, it's fun watching them run pick and roll and do cool dunks that's we've done that for a couple years already, so now it's time that you're expecting them to be taking steps forward, and they haven't. It's kind of they're just kind of going along on the same path. It doesn't seem like they've grown as a team.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. It's depressing. They're depressing. It's weird. Like, because they're really good, but they're so like you said, I'm with you that I can't remember another team where I've kind of felt the same, acknowledging they're really good, but at the same time just being meh about.
One team that's 20-20, but I have much more faith in as this season goes on, is the Oklahoma City Thunder. They're 3 games out, but only 2 games behind the Suns in the loss. You don't see any way the Thunder missed the playoffs, do you?
Oh no, I see a way. I mean, they're you know, an injury to, you know, one of their top three dudes is you know, that keeps them out more than a game or two is going to be pretty tough to handle, I think. But you know, that you can say that about anybody. But that aside, I mean, I would be very surprised if they stay healthy and do not make the playoffs. Yes,
Michael Carter Williams just tried to kill Chris Humphreys. Jesus. and as people listen, they'll be like, "What the hell is this idiot talking about?" That happened yesterday. Sorry. I like the trade they make, and I like how it's worked so far with Dion Waiters. You hate Dion Waiters, so we're going to fight.
The trade in and of itself, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I like the idea of the move more than the actual move. They are a team where they are now. They should basically never have their own first-round pick by the end of the year. Is kind of how I feel about them. This year it may be a little different, being with their struggles with injuries. But in their window, they should be adding, you know, that last bit of talent for their, you know, that the 27th pick or whatever at the deadline or earlier, kind of every year. So I like the aggressiveness of the move. I don't like Dion Waiters, but that's kind of a matter of taste and judgment more than. Then, you know, I like the idea of them adding talent. On the flip side, if it means that they're, you know, making a financial decision on Reggie Jackson, I don't like that as much, because this is a team that has already kind of torpedoed a potential dynasty by, you know, and not comparing Reggie Jackson to James Harden or anything, but you know, it's a pattern, and we all see it coming, and it's. As a proud son of the Pacific Northwest, I'm gleeful over it, but if I was a Thunder fan, I would be pretty displeased over, you know, the kind of the constant cheapness from a team that makes huge amounts of money every year.
I will be really upset if they trade Reggie Jackson, because what I like that Sam Presti has done right now is he's put, because one thing Scott Brooks has a history of doing as a coach is he does his best to keep players happy. We've seen it with his overplaying of Kendrick Perkins in the past, him keeping Derek Fisher involved in the rotation. The more veteran guys he's going to keep happy and make sure they get their minutes. And how Sam Presti has constructed this roster right now is forcing Scott Brooks to play a bunch of different small ball units with Kevin Durant at the four to get everyone the proper amount of run, and I think that really helps Oklahoma City.
Yeah, no, it's almost the exact opposite of last year, where they signed Caron Butler, which should have, you know, you know that if you're going to sign Caron Butler, that means that you're burying Jeremy Lamb, which that was, and that's what happened last year. So it is, and this maybe gets back a little bit to our coach's GM convo, is that if you know your coach has a certain sort of little, you know, blind spot or something like that, you can kind of steer away from that. If there's a dedicated, you know, a different decision maker, you know, in Toronto, Dwayne Casey was horrified of losing Rudy Gay, and that, you know, that trade probably saved his job because he was unable to use Rudy Gay in a way that that made sense. And so I think you're right that, you know, in a way forcing kind of Brooks to play to kind of his rosters and his best player's strengths a little bit more now is probably helpful.
It's only been 19 minutes, so obviously small sample size and whatnot, but with Westbrook, Waiters, Jackson, and Durant on the court, they're a 41.3 positive net rating. And what I like it, they've had some time with Perkins, they've had some time with Ibaka. With Ibaka out there, what you have is, you basically have five guys who force your defense to contort in weird ways. And that, I just don't, what teams are going to end up doing is when you start game planning is you would think that basically they're going to try and force Jackson and Waiters into jumpers would be my guess is how you just generally defend that group. But with you have four guys who can create off the bounce and are willing to pass. I mean, that's really hard to defend.
Again, with Dion Waiters involved for some definition of willingness to pass, but
that's
my last Dion Waiters cheap shot for this.
When he runs, to be fair, and you're right, your criticisms of Dion Waiters are also fair. He'll over dribble at times. He'll make a pass 2 seconds later than it should be made, but he'll also force a defense to bend when he goes hard to the basket. And he's not afraid to kick it out and start that ball flying around the perimeter for an open three.
No, you're not wrong. And I in the brief, you know, time it's been on the floor that bomb squad lineup of, you know, with Ibaka especially it's certainly an intriguing lineup for just, you know, a 5 minute just guys running around, running, jumping, shooting, blitz. It's certainly potentially a pretty, you know, thrilling lineup to watch, and try to imagine that, like, stretches of that against, say, like Golden State or Phoenix, that's, you know, basketball on speed. So from a viewing standpoint, that's certainly fun, and it's a nice wrinkle to have in the bag to be able to, you know, change up how they're playing like that.
Thank God they didn't trade for Brook Lopez.
I mean, if people had, you know, criticisms of you know, Oklahoma City having a stagnant stand-around offense before, just imagine if they added Brook Lopez.
Yeah, and I actually think Ibaka's not a terrible guy to pair next to him. I just don't like what it would have done for their style of play, as you kind of quickly hit on right there.
Yeah. It's funny you say that about Ibaka, because it's just like any like indifferent, shall we say, defensive big, who would be ideal to pair him with? Serge Ibaka. It's like, you know, he's kind of the fix-all for, I mean, who would be the best big man on a play besides Kevin Love? Serge Ibaka. How about Al Jefferson? Serge Ibaka. So he's such a unique player in terms of his ability to, you know, be a legit rim protector and a legit stretch four.
You know, I don't like him next to Love that much because I think they'd cramp each other a little bit on the perimeter.
Yeah, that's true, and then that maybe gets into, you know, how does one best use Kevin Love, which is something that they're struggling with still in Cleveland. I think I've talked about this a fair amount. It may seem like a waste, but using him as for, like, you know, weak side post ups and spot ups is the way I would do it with this current Cleveland team, just because of certainly with the way his back is, he's not necessarily mobile enough to be, you know, the guy in the primary initiating action of every play, as I see it. But that's neither here nor there.
You know what? Speaking of the East, you started talking about the Eastern Conference, so sure. Let's stay there.
Okay.
Hawks.
So much fun.
I liked them coming into the season. I think I did over-unders. It was like 41. They were one of the teams I picked over. But I'm not even going to pretend I expected anything like this.
I was big on the Hawks coming into this season. Obviously, yes, I wasn't expecting this. But I thought before Horford got hurt last year, they were the third best team in the East. They addressed some of their roster issues, and also had some, Damari Carroll, who was kind of the weak link last year, got a little bit better, and Dennis Schroeder got a lot better. And all of a sudden, they're a team that goes, 11 deep and just plays, gorgeous basketball while doing it, which is, why everyone's kind of head over heels for them at the moment is they're, aesthetically just super pleasing on both ends of the floor, I should say.
You on Twitter the last couple of days have been talking a lot about Kyle Korver's effectiveness. What makes him so special?
Well, first of all, he's got a really strange career arc. Like people, a lot of Bulls fans especially are, the Kyle Korver who left Chicago is not the same player as the guy who's in Atlanta.
He was still good. He was good.
He was good. He was good, but he's improved subtly in ways that let him just be on the court more. Like he was a 25-minute a game player for first wing off the bench or the first wing to go to the bench kind of role for his entire career, playing for a lot of pretty good coaches and decent teams. He improved his defense a little bit, improved his passing a little bit, and just those little improvements. And then finding the perfect system just turn him into, I think, an all-star level player. And obviously that's within, within context, but he's spectacular. Now, obviously, the thing that everyone wants to talk about is his shooting, but I want to lead with something else because I think it's incredibly reductive to see him as just a shooter. Probably just thinking about how he has the effect he does, the biggest thing is he might be like one of the best conditioned players in the NBA for the sheer amount of running he does on every offensive possession. He's got to have the lungs of a horse.
He runs more in one offensive possession. I played about 2 hours of pickup ball this weekend than I'm pretty sure I do the entire time I play.
Yeah, and that's that I think that may be if you're looking for specifics for improvements, like that's one right there is maybe he was in bad shape, but it's like if you read stuff about like the kind of the crazy Zen workouts he does every summer or whatever, like the adventure stuff he does, like he goes above and beyond, I think, what the would be professionally responsible, I guess, is the way I put it. So, and that's, that's credit to him, obviously.
Robin Lundberg, he's a ESPN radio host in New York, had a good tweet about, he was talking about Al Horford, and he compared him to Tim Duncan in demeanor, and I actually like that, and I'll take it a step further. Horford's kind of like, he's a poor man, and don't take this as there's nothing wrong with being a poor man no. of one of the greatest basketball players of all time, but he really is kind of a poor man Duncan in how he plays. I think that was a pretty apt comparison.
He's somewhere between it's weird because they often get compared to each other. He's somewhere between a poor man's Duncan and a poor man's Garnett. Though his demeanor is obviously much closer to Duncan than to Garnett, but just in terms of especially how in his prime KG was, Horford's he's a decent low post player, but he really his a lot of what he does offensively is kind of at the elbows and being able to move and pass and shoot that jumper well enough that you have to guard him there, which. Even relative to the all the 3-point talent they have, that's that's not a shot you should be giving up as defense, because he's one of the few players in the NBA for whom that's true. So, but yeah, he's, you know, he started the year off a little slow, and now that he's kind of regained all-star form, I think that's as much of anything kind of kicked in this incredible streak they're on.
What I like what you said about how it's a good shot for him to take, and I think that's helpful. Going to be helpful come playoff time. Because as much I'm as big of a fan as the threes and layups, and that those are the shots you should be working for to get. But it's also important to have court balance and be able to effectively get shots in other areas when a team does a good job taking away what you're trying to do, and that could be helpful for them as things get into the nitty-gritty a little bit.
Exactly. I mean, it's almost, if you know, that mid-range is kind of a moat almost from between the three-point line and the basket, and having a guy who can kind of operate in that area, I mean, it just makes if a defense has to kind of cover all three zones equally hard, then there's a pretty good chance that they're going to make a mistake somewhere. Whereas I think in the past, you've maybe seen a little bit with the Rockets that, you know, by completely ignoring that mid-range, it's allowed teams to kind of lock down a little bit more on you know, the paint and arc, just because they're so extreme in their dependence on the not mid-range shot. And you know, threatening that area where most teams are kind of, certainly the smarter defenses are saying, you know, that's the shot we're designed to give up, except now we can't give that shot up. What do we do? That has a certain amount of value, I think, yeah.
Where's your concern level with the Raptors? 3-7 in their last 10, haven't been playing. They've kind of dipped a little bit recently.
I'd be concerned. I didn't think they were as good as they were at the start of the season, so I'm not totally surprised. Lou Williams wasn't going to, you know, hit jumpers and one in people's faces all season, and that started to go away a little bit. They've got some weird rotation issues going on right now. Terrence Ross is really struggling. It does some strange things for their offense, but you almost want to see them start James Johnson at small forward and just see how that goes, because at least that's going to shore up the defense and rebounding a little bit. And then they're just a lot of their guys are just not playing as well. Kyle Lowry's had a really tough month or so. Valanciunas is up and down. Amir Johnson is physically kind of a mess right now. Yeah, they're, you know, there's up and downs in every NBA season, and they're in a down right now, and, you know, they'd have half a season to get out of it, but if the playoffs started today, you wouldn't really feel great about their chances to win more than a round, would you?
No, I would not. I wouldn't. I think I'd rather Vasquez start than James Johnson.
Oh, no.
I like Vasquez and Lowry together.
That worked really well last year. Vasquez has been much worse this year than he was last year.
You're right. He has been. He finally played well. He played well in that last game against the Pelicans. I think he had 16-9 I believe he started the second half when Terrence Ross got benched. Yeah. But I think I would give that a shot again. I kind of like James Johnson. I think I like James Johnson coming off the bench and playing him with Patterson, so you have a little bit more court spacing versus with Amir Johnson.
Yeah. So, I mean, Amir, it's weird. Amir Johnson is actually a competent 3-point shooter, even though he's got a kind of a funky looking shot from deep. But I think Casey is old school enough that he kind of discourages that shot, even though it's a. You could do worse than, you know, Amir Johnson getting an open three. Though he doesn't seem as confident as maybe his shooting numbers would suggest he should be.
All right, you have to pick two of these five teams.
Okay.
Miami, Brooklyn, Charlotte, Detroit, Pacers.
To do what? What am I picking them for?
Seven, they're the seventh and eighth seeds.
Oh, jeez. Miami and Indy.
You're bailing on the Pistons. So you're really going strong on the Pistons can't keep shooting like they can. Like they have been, huh?
Yeah, they
You don't think Brandon Jennings is the best point guard in the NBA?
No. him and Dion are my guys.
His PR is like, I know that's a volume based stat, but still, it's almost like 29. Like 30. Since it's like, holy shit.
Yeah, no, this is going to sound like, as someone who's been, you know, down on the Smith move, this is going to sound a little bit like sour grapes, and maybe it is, but since they've just got caught so many breaks. It's, you know, from the, you know, the Spurs meltdown, which kind of kicked off this whole thing. Like, you know, it's not the other team like goes 4 of 10 from the free throw line in the last 2 minutes. It's a nice win, but come on. And then like their last win against the Pacers, like they get the last possession off a charge call that drew a flop warning. It was, you know, it's like, you know, they're just so many things, and that's before we even get into like Brendan Jennings suddenly turning into like, you know, Steph Curry, a left-handed Steph Curry, and he's taking some shots that Steph would be embarrassed by. So, you know, I'm not in on the Pistons. You know, and even honestly, even if they made the playoffs, I would still think that you know, eating Smith's contract for 5 years was bad, but that's another discussion. And you know, I'm learning to accept the fact that people just aren't going to agree with me on that. If they keep, you know, playing well,
I'm on your side. I don't think the stretch provision is weird. I don't know what context I would actually use that, except for like a really, really low salary player.
Yeah, it's someone in the last year of their contract, and all right, we'll take a $3 million hit over 3 years or something.
No,
like that.
I wouldn't do that.
Like it's at least, you know, it's you okay, it's at least maybe. It's just, but they're you know, not knowing exactly what the salary cap is going to be. They're still, you know, starting next year at around 8% and down to like 5% of the salary cap by the end of it. They're playing at that much of a disadvantage for the next, you know, 5 years, and I think that, you know, people seem to not be cognizant of the fact that that's a real asset they're giving up. That's you would not have traded, you know, five consecutive second round picks to get rid of Josh Smith, would you?
No.
And I think that the cap space is more valuable than that. So
I would have How many second round picks would have you attached to Josh Smith to get rid of that contract?
That's a good question, and I don't know. You know, would have been less than the next five. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, you know, I think two. Besides, kept wanting to start the process of changing their culture and what they were trying to do, and
just send them home. Like,
how,
you know,
many years were left on his deal?
Two more after this year, which is why it's so like they're. This is why they'll be paying for 5 years.
Yeah, that's a long time to send someone home for.
Well, yeah, but you still have, you know, the option of you know, you can still work out for trade. Even if you trade him for three other bad contracts, though you can start to chip away at those. If you like, he's making like 13.5. You trade him for, you know, three guys each making five. You can kind of start to chip away at those and other deals, and so instead of, you know, having A, he's gone, and B, you know, instead of having, you know, $13 million tied up in this player, the spot you're getting nothing from, you have, you know, seven. Because you've traded a second round pick to someone else to take on, I don't know, Jason Thompson or something like that. Just, we're assuming that they were going to try to trade him to Sacramento. So I, you know, there was so many other ways that they could have done something and get him away. If getting him away from the team was the thing, and, you know, is cutting him like that much more effective than just sending him home? I mean, I don't know. And and to do it 2 months before the trade deadline and just to not take that time to avoid not having this, you know, huge financial burden hanging over the team that is not just, it's not just money. It's not like when you fire a coach with years left in his contract and you owe him. I mean, because that's just the owner's money. This is like actually a competitive detriment to them for 5 years. And, you know, I don't know how many wins you would need this year to make it worth it, but they're not getting enough. There's, you know, if they suddenly became a 60 win team this year, okay, fine. That's, you know, I get that, but that's, you know, okay. They're maybe a 500 level team now. And that's, you know, do you go into Hawk for 5 years to become a 500 team? That's how you stay a 500 team.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the Heat as one of the teams you would have taken. Have you watched a lot of Hassan Whiteside?
Just a very little. He's, you know, we'll see how it works out. I mean, Amin El-Hassan has talked about it a little bit about kind of the reasons why he bounced out of the league. And, you know, we'll see if that, I guess you'd say the attitude problems that were.
What did he say? Why did I miss that?
He's basically, I mean, when he, in pre-draft stuff, he was basically like, you know, there's guys who come in and are confident, and then there's guys who are delusional, just in terms of their place in the grand scheme of basketball. And I've heard this from other folks who've done like draft stuff as well, that he was very much the latter in terms of you know, like. You know, I'm offended that I'm not a top five pick kind of thing, and I should be starting from day one kind of stuff.
Oh, jeez.
I may have the details of that wrong, and I don't want to put words in Amin's mouth, but that's you know, it was along those lines of, you know, like, you know, there's confidence is good, like, but at a certain point, calm down, buddy.
You need some measure of self awareness along with confidence. But you know, with where the Heat are, the exact type of player they should have been looking on the waiver wire for to take a chance on a young guy.
Oh, absolutely,
with talent and upside. With where, I mean, that team needs they need to find young talent somewhere, and if they were able to find maybe a 20-minute center a night who's now willing to accept what his role is and with the potential to grow in to more, that's big for them.
No, absolutely. I'm not at all saying it was a bad gamble for them. It's obviously paid off huge. But it's just, you know, people wondering like, well, they look at the guy with that size and athleticism and wonder what happened. Well, you know, that's what happened. I mean, it's, you know, it's a little bit of kind of a JaVale McGee without the massive contract story almost.
I'm on record in the boat of saying that the Heat are better off losing and keeping their pick.
Huh. I mean, I think that may be. I think that they're not an organization that's going to take that route.
That, which is, I mean, they need... I mean, Napier's, I haven't seen anything from him that I really like or that I love. He's a rookie, though, so there's always time for him to grow and improve. I mean, you have Wade, who's on his last leg, still playing well when he plays, but doesn't stay healthy consistently.
They've gotten pretty, I mean, getting nothing from Josh McRobbins this year, basically. I mean, they've been a little bit unlucky. I actually thought they were going to be better. But I guess I'm going to call a mulligan on that just based on, you know, okay, you can build in, you know, Wade missing a fair amount of time into your calculus, but, But just the amount of you know, stuff that's gone on in terms of Bosch being out and you know, Granger being done probably, and
well,
and
Granger you kind of expected.
Yeah, and McRoberts, like, basically, like I said, giving them nothing all season, and I think he would have been a, you know, a big, you know, a big addition for just in terms of, you know, some legit size with defense and a little bit more passing ability, would let them, you know, get away with you know, maybe substandard point guard play. And I haven't understood the decision. I guess I understand why, but I don't like the decision to go with Norris Cole over Mario Chalmers for a lot of the year.
Your McRoberts would have fit really well in that team to kind of cover up some of their flaws from the guard position. That 100% right.
Yeah.
And yeah, the injury stuff, like, yeah, you could have expected with, I would have expected Dang to miss some games because he's got some years on him. He played under Thibodeau, who ran him into the ground.
Yeah.
Wade, we know the history, but to get no, you're right, not a single contribution from McRoberts on a consistent basis all season was just something you never could have pegged. And I didn't like the Heat going into the year. I think I picked them to be the eighth seed and didn't really even want to pick them to make the playoffs, but even I didn't think it would go like this.
Yeah, it's too bad too, because I think it's if they were doing a little bit better, it would be clear that, you know, why Bosch was so highly thought of kind of before the Big Three era, because, you know, he stepped up his game like I think expectedly for people who follow these things, and kind of the parallels with Kevin, with, you know, how Kevin Love has kind of struggled, you know, moving into a similar role in Cleveland, people are like, oh, I see, you know, I just, the importance of, you know, of the role in a guy, in the numbers a guy is putting up, and actually how valuable and intrinsic he was to the Heat's success is, I wish they were being better so we would be talking more about, you know, in retrospect, we should have given Chris Bosh more credit kind of stuff.
All right, I know you want to go watch some basketball, so plug whatever you need to and with life.
Let me see. I just published a couple things today. I've been messing around with a lot of the SportView stuff and kind of one kind of looking at the ways in which Kyle Korver is most effective. His effective field goal percentage is sit like 78% early in the shot clock, which is absurd. And I also have, you know, kind of diving into, you know, we talk about, you know, guys who steal rebounds, Lance Stephenson famously, and I kind of took a first pass at trying to value that
yeah,
or devalue that skill.
I have that article favorited. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. So how do you, looking at the data, figure out the stealing rebounds thing?
Well, the short version is the Sport View breaks rebounds into contested and uncontested, and kind of with a, you know, some very rudimentary mathematical modeling, kind of derived the value of an uncontested defensive rebound is about half of a quote real rebound, and so kind of going from there is essentially like that's the short version of it, is because you know. Every team in the NBA is going to get between 54% and 60% or so of opponents' misses. They're just going to get uncontested, and so whoever ends up with those rebounds isn't necessarily doing a whole lot, but they're doing something because just chasing a rebound has value because you don't want to give up free rebounds to the offense. So, and just kind of that's the basis of it. And just kind of going from there, without, you know, diving too deeply into extreme nerdery.
And Seth has done a real cool job going through this SportVU stuff and coming up with all different things throughout the season. If you just follow him on Twitter, at Seth Partnow, P-A-R-T-N-O-W, Seth, I hope you can spell that, because that's not that hard. You'll see all of his articles go out over there. Seth, thank you very much. Always appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Yep. Enjoy all the games today.
Yep, you too. All right, that wraps up another edition of the Podium Game Podcast.